Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I hope I don't have a strong effect on and hope we do well through the afternoon. I'm going to be done before the break. The judge has made it very clear as to what my limit is appropriately. And so you're about to hear the sprint to the finish here, because I won't be able to touch on everything I would like, but I'm going to try to hit the high points. I was finishing by talking about Mr. Rubin and Mr. Palermo. And the point I was making, obviously, is that proving a negative is a challenging thing. We could call in every witness who works for any of these many institutions that were listed, and you would be here for the rest of the year, and it would still be said, well, you missed this department, you missed that department. Mr. Kogan, in his argument, said all we did regarding Rubin and Palermo was say there are no documents. That's all we pointed out. No, that's not all we did. We did call witnesses. We called the witnesses who worked in the Fumo office on every floor at Tasker, at Harrisburg. We called it, asked at least a dozen witnesses, key people, Lillian Cozzo, Jamie Spagna, Marianne Cortullo, the people who handled the affairs, people in Harrisburg, all of those budget analysts. None of them knew anything about Rubin or Palermo doing any work. All of the evidence is totally consistent. At some point, you have to say, there's nothing there. These are contracts that are unnecessary. This is work that's not being done. There's no evidence of any work. No one has ever seen them do any work, except Mr. Fumo, who testifies, and also testifies falsely about numerous other matters as I went through with you. For example, Mr. Kogan says, oh, well, they only asked Vince Rossi. He's not the right guy to ask. He's the budget analyst. What would he know about the turnpike? No, that's, again, misstating the testimony. Mr. Rossi said there are few turnpike issues that come to the Appropriations Committee because it has a separate budget, but any that do come to me because that's part of what I do. And, in fact, Act 44, you heard, eventually came along where the turnpike and I-80 became a huge issue in 2007. And Mr. Rossi suggested that of course, he got on it because that's what he did for the Appropriations Committee. Mike Palermo wasn't advising about exit ramps. They had well-paid, well-qualified people in Harrisburg to deal with this. It's all a lie. It's all a fraud. It's a massive theft of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Before I move on to Citizens Alliance, I just want to clarify one thing I said before. I was talking about those 302s, and if I wasn't clear about it, these FBI reports, not only are they just summaries, not only are they not adopted by the witnesses, but they're not in evidence. You're not going to see any of these in evidence. These are statements and summaries that are written out of court, kept by the FBI agents for their purposes. What you have is the testimony that was presented to you here in court, and that's what I want to talk about. And that brings us to Citizens Alliance, which is very important. The first huge issue with this is the exempt purpose of Citizens Alliance. Mr. Jacobs had a new argument that he presented to you, and it was astonishing. If we look at Exhibit 900 and go to page 9, these are the amended Articles of Incorporation as of 1994. You heard, and I said it in my closing, the exempt purpose is a fundamental concept. This is what the IRS looks to make sure that people aren't taking tax-free money and just going and doing whatever they want with it, when certain things, obviously, people should be paying tax on. And so you have to state your exempt purpose. You heard from Lisa Petkin. If you're not specific about it, they're going to come back and ask you questions. And you saw that with the Riparian Defense Fund. So what is the exempt purpose? It's the first sentence: to promote public health, housing, safety, and education in the city and county of Philadelphia. The next paragraph says the following limitations apply. So now we're limiting what you can do as far as the exempt purpose. But look at how Mr. Jacobs reads this. For the very first time, he goes through the sentence that says, it shall not carry on any activities not permitted to be carried on by a corporation. So what's the limitation? The limitation is we will not do anything that the IRS says we can't do. We will not do what a 501c3 can't do. What can a 501c3 not do? Political campaign activity and substantial lobbying. You know the answer to that. Mr. Jacobs reads this and says, it's a double negative, not. And the double negative means the opposite. The double negative means this organization has no exempt purpose. It can do whatever it wants. The double negative means we can do anything that any 501c3 can do anywhere in the world, despite what's in that first paragraph. Another of these things that I don't think you would believe if you weren't present to hear it for yourself. He never asked a single witness about this during the trial. Never had the temerity to ask a witness, to say that this is what it says. Instead, every witness, Emilio, Cobasa, Beckman, Petkin, every witness who testified said, you got to have an exempt purpose, you got to state it, and the exempt purpose of this organization is limited to Philadelphia. Mr. Jacobs stood before you, and he said, this is plain as day, his interpretation. He said, and I quote, there is no other way to interpret these documents honestly with a conscience other than what I have just told you. This is more an example of acting that you saw in this case than legal argument. To suggest that that sentence, that's a limitation on what citizens can do, means it can do anything. And then Mr. Kogan, of course, adopted it. He said, his words were, it's silly as can be, he said, to think that this organization is limited in any way. And of course, Mr. Fumo said there was no geographical limitation. There was. If we look at Art Emilio's testimony on page 38, he said what every other witness said in the case when he was asked about the exempt purpose. And he answers it right there, promote health, safety, education, and welfare. That is the exempt purpose. Did anyone ever tell you that the mission changed in any way? No. Go to the tax returns. Exhibit 1313 is the latest, but you can go to every one, every 990 that was filed. You have to tell the IRS every year, what are you doing? Have you changed your exempt purpose in any way? And every year they tell them the same thing, which is that limitation that we're doing health, safety, education, and welfare in the city of Philadelphia. No double negative. None of this that's being suggested here. So, and then he suggested, let's look quickly, Defense Exhibit 770.12. This was shown to Mr. Beck, an amendment was made to that second paragraph, that limitation paragraph, in 2002. And Mr. Jacobs says to you in his argument, Beckman agreed with you. Beckman agreed that this 501c3 can do anything that any 501c3 can do. That's not what happened. That's not the testimony that Mr. Beckman gave you. He was shown this for a different reason. Because if you notice, the double negative, this now famous double negative, was there back in 1994. It did not change. It's still there in 2002. What's new in 2002 is they got more specific about the limitation. Lisa Petkin wrote a couple more sentences that explicitly say, we won't do substantial lobbying, we won't do political campaigns, and added that on. When Beckman testified on cross, Mr. Jacobs tried a little thing here too. He showed him only this paragraph and said, oh, doesn't this broaden what Citizens Alliance can do? And that's when Mr. Beckman said, they are saying that in carrying out their exempt purpose, they'll do whatever they're allowed to do. In other words, they won't do campaigning, they won't do other things, but they're not limited in any other way in carrying out their exempt purpose. Again, leaving out the redirect. Mr. Pease stood up and made it very clear with Mr. Beckman that this does not change the paragraph that comes before it, which is the paragraph that defines the exempt purpose. And he said, and I quote, Mr. Pease asked, what city is the exempt purpose limited to? And Mr. Beckman said, quote, city of Philadelphia, end quote. And yet Mr. Jacobs presented this different argument to you. What is going on here? The interesting question here is not, is Mr. Jacobs' argument wrong? Does this double negative mean that an organization can do anything in the world? Because of course it's absurd. The really interesting question is, why does he present this argument to you? He knows that you're intelligent and can read these documents and in English. He knows I'm going to stand up here and say exactly what I'm saying right now. The reason, of course, is there's nowhere else for them to go. The exempt purpose is fundamental. They are limited to doing what they tell the IRS they will do. You can't justify any of the things that are done for Mr. Fumo. Cuba, Ventnor, the Jubilee lawsuit, the war dog statute, wonderful as those veterans are. You can't violate your exempt purpose. That's what this is about. And so that's why you've got this effort, absurd as it is, to say we have no exempt purpose. They knew it. This is why. It's just like the Ethics Act. Just like they know the Ethics Act has a restriction, they know of these legal restrictions. And this is why the lies. This is why Riparian Defense Fund for Ventnor Dunes sends in a description to the IRS that says, we're going to deal with all the waterways in the Mid-Atlantic region instead of saying what they're really doing, because they know they can't violate the exempt purpose. This is why the false brief is filed with the Commonwealth Court in the Jubilee lawsuit that says Mr. Fumo takes no position, rather than telling the court the truth, which is that this nonprofit organization is paying for the lawsuit and it's funded by Senator Fumo and he's the one behind this. Throughout their arguments, and again, I won't be able to go into every detail, But throughout their arguments, you just have these casual misstatements of the evidence, hoping that it'll just go by you and go by me and Mr. Pease. You know, Exhibit 1476, the famous exhibit on January 25th. You were argued to by the lawyers that this puts Scandone on notice, that they're deleting and that they have this practice of deleting emails. It doesn't say it anywhere there. And yet you were told this over and over again. Exhibit 1714, the Sprague email that is forwarded, the one email that's forwarded that does not say anything about deleting or wiping. And that's what Mr. Fumo forwards to Mr. Sprague. Mr. Kogan argues to you that, this does say they're wiping the servers. Because they have backups, and they're taking the backups somewhere else, this means he's being told wiping the servers. They're telling you the opposite of what you can see with your plain eyes. And that has to tell you something if this is the way the defense argues its case. Here's the Seaport Museum. This will save me some time later on. Exact same thing. Mr. Kogan shows you two little snippets from the ethics policy. He says, look at this. The thing about Carter at the end here trumps that other thing earlier on. Thank you very much. That's my argument regarding the Seaport Museum. I showed you the provisions of the ethics policy. I also showed you the provisions of the bylaws, which he didn't show you, that says conflict of interest. It has to be submitted to the board if a director is doing a transaction or getting something from the museum. But they'll just show you one line, like the double negative, and say with apparent sincerity and great eloquence, this shows that we can do anything we want. We are the one nonprofit in the United States that has no limitation, no exempt purpose. We can go anywhere and do anything we want, and the IRS has no issue. This is the kind of arguments we've listened to. Here's another. And this was true throughout Mr. Jacobs' argument, affecting everything about Citizens Alliance. Every time he talked to you about any of the things that were going on, he kept saying we. It's very critical. It's the same thing that happened in the opening statement. We did this. We thought it was a good thing to do. We thought, what would be good for Mr. Fumo? He said, and I quote, when he's talking about Fumo, can't we do anything for you? When he's talking about the polls, he said, it's in your best interest to do anything and everything you can to keep him at the top of his game. Remember when one of the examples he gave, he talked about the benevolent man in the town. That was his example. Some guy who just does lots of wonderful things for a nonprofit, helps him out, does a fundraiser, and then the nonprofit people get together and say, what can we do for this gentleman? And the gentleman says, well, here are the kinds of things I like. Remember he went on, you know, with that example? What's he talking about? It's almost like there's a parallel universe being laid out for you here that never happened. There is no we. Every decision that was made about Cuba, about Ventnor Dunes, about polls, were made by Mr. Fumo. The reason that Ms. Arnao is here is because she did whatever he told her to do. She wrote the checks. She allowed the principles of this organization to be violated in exchange for the ever-increasing amounts of money that she was being paid by all of these different organizations. He decided everything. You would think, listening to Mr. Jacobs, that Mr. Jacobs was even there, along with Ruth Arnao and the board members, sitting around drinking some of that soda that Dave Nelson is stocking in the refrigerator and saying, what can we do for that great guy, Vince Fumo? When what's really happening here is Vince Fumo is sitting there saying, what can I do for that great guy, Vince Fumo? That is the case. Not this parallel universe that is being laid out for you that never happened, that no one testified about. The directors were not there. Now they say, what's the big deal? The directors like us. And so where's the crime? Who's the victim? Of course the directors like them. These are their friends. They stock the board with their friends who are happy not to show up. And that lets them do whatever they want. So here's the principle of corporate law that you're being asked to endorse and announce. That an elected official can create a nonprofit organization, stuff the board with his cronies who are willing not to even show up, and then he can take anything he wants for himself. That's what you're being suggested. You're not going to hear it from the judge. You're not going to hear it in the law because, of course, it's outrageous. It's a complete fraud on this nonprofit organization. Who's the victim? Citizens Alliance is the victim. The taxpayers are the victim who are subsidizing this organization through this tremendous benefit of a tax-exempt privilege. And then they come in and just take things for themselves. So Mr. Jacobs asked the question, can Fumo legally get this? He says, can a nonprofit give a gift? well, of course a nonprofit can give a gift. But that's not the question in this case. The question in this case is, can he take a gift, if it's even a gift, from the nonprofit for himself? He's deciding for himself what he's going to take. And the answer is no. This is what the judge instructed you on. This is what I mentioned. It was left out in the defense closings. You can't commit a fraud in pursuit of an end that might be legal if somebody did it. An employee cannot say it would be legal if they gave me an extra $20,000, if that's what they decide to do, so I'm just going to go take it. That's illegal. You can't do that. You have to go through the legal mechanisms, which in this case would involve the board of the directors. The board never knew about any of this. Everyone, to a man, testified. They never knew about any of these different things that we listed here. And it's more than that. Not only can he, like any employee, not decide for himself what he's taking, which is what happened, but he can't do it under the Ethics Act. He has additional restrictions that are important because he's a public official. The other part of the Ethics Act that's very important here is that Contino and Faber both testified about, is you can't run any organization out of your office that you profit from. You can't use Senate resources, Senate staff, to run your business, your nonprofit, whatever, that you're profiting from. He can't do this. And he knows it. And again, that's why everything is taken in such a crazy, fraudulent way. That's why he's taking hot dog buns as opposed to checks. They know this. They know the rules. And they violate them with abandon year after year after year. And if they have to come in here and tell you a different story of a reality that never existed, that of course tells you a lot right there. It answers every one of the examples Mr. Jacobs gave. Why not give him a $25,000 watch? Why not take him to the Palm every week for dinner? Why not throw him a fundraising banquet? The answer is always the same. No. If he's the one deciding and he's taking it for himself and he's getting it from an organization that he runs out of his office, no. They tell you over and over again, this is the constituent services arm of the Senate. Well, of course, the constituent services arm of the Senate cannot pay him a profit where he's running the office as a senator in his office. This is not rocket science. I mean, the prohibition of the Ethics Act is very clear and very obvious, and I'm sure you would have guessed it existed even if you hadn't been told about it. Well, instead, Mr. Jacobs tries another thing. Oh, the Ethics Act doesn't apply to him at all. Mr. Kogan didn't go this far. Mr. Kogan said there's a dispute about which Ethics Act. There's no dispute. It's clear as day. But Mr. Jacobs said, no, the Legislative Code of Ethics, this other earlier law, is more specific. It only deals with legislators, not the whole all public officials. Therefore, it applies to Mr. Fumo. Again, no evidence in the case to support it. A misstatement of the testimony. Mr. Contino said both acts apply. What Mr. Contino said is, quote, and I don't see any real inconsistencies between the two laws. And as I've said before, even if there was an inconsistency in a particular provision of this law that can be argued to exist, the ethics law in Title 65, the one we administer and have prior jurisdiction over, has the conflict of law provision in it that takes priority. That's what Mr. Contino told you. And Mr. Fumo agreed. In his cross-examination, he agreed that there's no conflict in these two laws, and they both apply. So why is Mr. Jacobs suggesting to you that Contino agreed with him that the earlier more specific act applies? It's simply not true. They say different things. The Legislative Code of Ethics, and you can read it, it's in evidence, says that a legislator can take a gift from a nonprofit. There are certain areas in which he cannot take a gift, but nonprofits are exempted. So you can take a gift from a nonprofit. The Ethics Act is addressing completely different things. It says you can't take a gift from anyone if you're running it out of your office. That's a different proposition, and thus both acts can apply. And also, fundamentally, the Ethics Act is all about disclosure. Even if you can do things that are perfectly legal, you have to disclose all of your income and gifts to the public so that the public can evaluate for itself whether you're conflicted in any way. Everything gets reported, whether it's from a nonprofit or not. These acts work fine together. And Mr. Fumo acknowledged that because it's very clear when you look at it. He never disclosed what he got from Citizens Alliance, never disclosed what he got from the Independent Seaport Museum. Again, these are smart people. They know the rules. There's a reason that happened. I'm not saying this because they need to be charged with an Ethics Act violation. No. But as the judge told you, you can consider the Ethics Act like you would consider any other evidence that explains why people act the way they do. And this explains what he had to do, what he needed to do. He knew it. And they were just violating it. They just wanted to get all of this bounty for him. And so they took it in bizarre ways, didn't disclose it, lied about it when asked about it, lied on the radio, something that they didn't, Mr. Kogan didn't even attempt to defend Mr. Fumo's conduct in that regard. The same thing applies to the fundraiser thing. That was kind of interesting. You know, I called the fundraiser defense, defense number two. Defense number one, which nobody talked about, was I didn't get anything, I didn't do anything. That was a defense that lasted until this trial started. And then we get all the evidence. They say Exhibit 1015 that Agent Humphreys did, they say that it's not worth the paper it's written on. Well, it's so unpersuasive that it's what finally got Mr. Fumo at last to admit that he got these tens of thousands of dollars of things from citizens that he'd been denying for years. And they come in with the fundraiser defense. And Mr. Kogan said we misquoted his opening. No, he didn't say that in his opening. And then read you a part of his opening that sounded exactly like what I said he said. I mean, I leave that up to you. They did have that defense that I can be paid as a fundraiser. Mr. Fumo abandoned it on the witness stand. He said on the witness stand, I didn't get anything from that lawsuit in my private capacity. Why did he say that? Because you'd heard from Christopher Craig. You had learned that as a senator using a Senate lawyer, he could not do the litigation in that way for a private benefit. Now, they're coming back and saying, well, the fundraiser defense lives, I guess because they don't want to acknowledge that the defense changed in the very same trial, but it did. And then we had defense number three with all these crazy definitions that they don't try to defend, of gift and income and perks and whatever it is. It's all very clear. He took all of this from Citizens Alliance, a nonprofit, that he ran out of his Senate office, took all these benefits for himself that he legally could not take, and then lied to the accountants, lied to the IRS, lied to anybody who asked questions about it. The case is as simple as the fraud on the Senate. The matter involving Tasker Street is another really good example of the defense effort to change the reality of what happened. Mr. Jacobs says it's a win-win proposition for everybody. The Fumo for Senate is happy. The Senate is happy. Citizens Alliance is happy. What's he talking about? Citizens Alliance doesn't collect roughly $100,000 in rent year after year after year because they're giving it away. And again, I'm falling into the trap. It's not they who are giving it away. It's Mr. Fumo. He's deciding all of this. I mean, imagine what you're being told here. Fumo for Senate got free rent. He is deciding that his political action committee that does nothing but be involved in campaigns is going to get free rent from the nonprofit charity that he also runs in his office. I mean, this is astounding. And that's what's being justified to you here. As predicted, you heard the defense of blaming the accountants. I told you that was coming, and I was not disappointed. Pretty amazing. I mean, Mr. Jacobs even said at one point, we're indicted for the accountants' mistakes, as if the government indicts people for putting no instead of NA or for putting accounting fees on line 30 instead of line 40. I told you what the case is about. The case is about the lies that Ms. Arnao and Mr. Fumo told to the accountants that then got put on the return. I told you about the false statements that were made, telling Mr. Emilio that Eastern Leasing does leasing, telling Mr. Beckman that the things being bought down the shore were necessary spare parts, telling Mr. Emilio that the Jubilee payment was for consulting and not for a lawsuit. All of these false statements that were made, and they didn't address any of them. And especially the key false statement, the heart of it all, which is Exhibit 1334, which is the polling. Right when they're in the middle of the polling, right when the Fitzpatrick campaign is going on, right when the Form 990 is due for 2002, the question has to be asked. Ms. Arnao won't give the answer. She tells Kobasa, email me and copy Mr. Fumo. She's got to get the answer from Senator Fumo. And the answer they give is community development consulting. So Mr. Kogan asks, how can Mr. Fumo be guilty for aiding and abetting tax fraud when he didn't see the tax returns and he didn't sign them? The answer, right there, Exhibit 1334. You give the accountants false information, you know what they're working on, you know what they're doing, and you know the reason they're asking the question. You are causing the filing of a false tax return under the law, as the judge explained it to you earlier. That's what this case is about, is this exhibit. Now, Mr. Kogan didn't address it, didn't mention it. Mr. Jacobs tried one thing about this very critical exhibit. He said, well, Emilio testified about this, and Emilio is a guy who made a false entry, made an incorrect entry to try to correct things. So maybe Emilio is the type of person who would make this up too. Well, a couple problems. First of all, Emilio is not the only one who saw this answer that said community development consulting. Gallagher and Kielbasa testified about it also, and they immediately put it on the tax return. You know they got the answer that they say they got. But, of course, again, Mr. Jacobs is leaving out the context of what Emilio said that's crucial here. Why did Emilio make that incorrect entry in the books to move the polling deduction from one place to another? He told you. What he told you was, I knew that Ruth Arnao had lied to me. I realized by 2004 that she had misled me about the polling that was taking place once I saw there was a huge new amount of polling and they were refusing to show us the polls. And he told you, he said, I'm a timid person, I don't like confrontation, I wasn't going to confront her. And instead, maybe I shouldn't have, I went and I just moved it from one column to another for the following year to try to avoid the problem. That's what happened here. That's the position that these defendants put them in. Those are the false statements that were made to the accountants that they are not, that they're simply not addressing. Mr. Kogan at one point this morning said, he said, where's the false representations? Mr. Fumo made no false representations in this case. It's not true, and you can start with this one if you're looking for one to start with. This went on and on. Mr. Jacobs said that the Jennifer Franklin document, where Ms. Arnao is laying this false groundwork for Citizens Alliance all the way back in 2000, saying that Fumo doesn't control it, that the board meets. You remember all the things it says there. And so Mr. Jacobs says, don't worry about that. It wasn't used for anything. It never went anywhere. Check your notes about Ms. Franklin's testimony. It was actually Mr. Jacobs who asked her the question and said, he said, quote, did you actually respond to press calls and give these answers that she had written down? And her answer, yes. She testified to you that this document was created so she could answer the specific questions that were being asked by the press, and that's what she used it for. And then when the accountants came along, they did exactly the same thing. More critically, and this gets to the heart of the polling thing and the tax issue, Mr. Jacobs said to you, he said he asked every accountant whether they asked Ms. Arnao back then whether anything went to Senator Fumo. And he said the answer he got here in court from every accountant was no. In fact, you'll remember he gave you one of those lists of things. He said, shouldn't the investigators have known these things? And he craftily just stuck in the middle there casually as if it's true. Shouldn't the investigators have known that none of the accountants ever asked Ms. Arnao whether Mr. Fumo got anything? Completely, utterly false. That question was not asked by Mr. Jacobs to any of the witnesses. In fact, the witnesses said exactly the opposite. Mr. Kielbasa was asked whether he, as a practice, asked each of his clients about compensation, asked each of his clients, where's the money going? Who's getting money from this organization? He said he always did. And in this instance, it was Ms. Arnao who he asked because she was the one with the information, and she never told him that Mr. Fumo got anything. Mr. Emilio, let's look at Mr. Jacobs' actual cross-examination of Mr. Emilio, starting here on page 10. Says, okay, now one of the last things you discussed with Mr. Pease was whether you had a conversation with Ruth Arnao about any services being provided to or received by Senator Fumo. Do you recall the question and answer? Yes. Okay, and as I recall your answer, she told you about his shoveling his driveway, renting some storage space, and him making compensation for those things. Yes. Okay, now let's go, I think, to the next page. I'm just wondering if this isn't writing anywhere, not to the best of my recollection. Now, what was behind the question that you say you asked? Was the possibility that Senator Fumo was a disqualified person, right? And she says, right. Then the next page. So in this conversation that you told us about, you were thinking to yourself, well, Senator Fumo may be a disqualified person, step one, right?
Right.
And if he is, I should find out if he's receiving anything of value, right? This was the testimony. And on direct, I'm not going to show it all to you, but you can remember it. On direct, what he said was, this question came up about the 03 return and the 03 audit. And he asked Ms. Arnao, does Senator Fumo get anything? And she said, we shovel his driveway, we collect his trash, and he pays us for that. And never disclosed this huge amount of stuff that he's continuing to get throughout 2003 for nothing that I showed you. This is defense number one in action. This is fraud. You want to know where's the fraud? Where are the false statements? These are the false statements. And the only way it was defended in this courtroom over the last week was by misrepresenting the evidence. The Exhibit 1351, you can see it in black and white. Mr. Lundy gets involved, and the accountants are still asking the same question. You want to know how credible Emilio is? And so Lundy responds because he's giving suggestions, and it's in 05 by now because they've been stalling it. They're still talking about the 03 returns. And in 05, Lundy suggests the answer. Occasionally, we provided services, trash removal, snow removal, graffiti, and we got full and fair consideration in money or money's worth. They're lying to Mr. Lundy, their own lawyer, at the beginning of 2005, Ms. Arnao, and at the direction of Mr. Fumo. Why? This is defense number one. Deny it. We didn't get anything. Put them off. Maybe we can avoid responsibility for what we did. It's an overwhelming case. Same thing with Mr. Beckman. If you look at his testimony, Mr. Jacobs tried to dismiss it by saying, oh, Beckman was too early. He was before all of this started. No, he wasn't. He told you he asked these questions. He instructed Ms. Arnao. He's the knowledgeable one. He repeatedly told her, you've got your exempt purpose. Your expenditures have to relate to your exempt purpose. You have to be able to explain them. I showed you one exhibit, 1325, in my closing, where he sent that three- or four-page list of items. 1326 is another one where he sent her a detailed list in 1998 asking her, how are you spending your money? What about the autos? And others, now, Mr. Fumo already has the Expedition and the Ford, the Ranger, and vehicles he's using at this point. She's being asked these questions, and Mr. Jacobs says they never asked, and is lying. Never discloses anything to the accountants. That's how you wind up with false tax returns. Same thing with Lisa Petkin, the lawyer. In this parallel universe, Lisa Petkin knows everything, reviews everything, and everything is fine with her, including especially Ventnor Dunes. They say she knew what was going on because Mr. Jacobs shows one exhibit that mentions the word referendum, where she and Mr. Craig are having a general discussion of the difference between a 501c3 and a 501c4, which is allowed to do a bit more of political activity, but no specific mention of any referendum or, importantly, where it is and what it's about. What did she testify? If we go to page 11 of her transcript, and she was asked this a number of times in many ways and gave the same answer, but here's one of them. We've heard about this Ventnor Dunes. Were you aware of that issue at the time you were representing citizens? I don't think I was aware of it then. I've been aware of it now, but I don't think I was at that time. Next page. Well, do you recall in connection with the establishment of this riparian defense fund that what you know about it? I don't recall any connection between them. She was hired to do the paperwork. She's the corporate lawyer who fills out the things they ask her to fill out. She told you in many ways she didn't know about Ventnor Dunes. She wasn't asked to comment on it. So what did Mr. Jacobs say to you in his argument? This is what he said, and I quote, she told you she knew exactly what was going on. There was no secret at all about this. End quote. That's what you heard in this courtroom last Thursday. Same thing with regard to polling. They say, we're the ones who are confused. How did this case come about? The government didn't know that what the limitations on political activity are. We wrongly thought that a nonprofit is barred from any political activity. And on that incorrect premise, the indictment was brought and Mr. Pease opened to the jury. Again, go to the record. Mr. Pease opening, the October 22nd. Here's the part that they were quoting without showing you. Very interesting. Mr. Pease says, the IRS has special rules for nonprofit organizations, and the rules are very simple. Basically, nonprofit organizations cannot be involved in political campaigns. They can't make political expenditures. And then later he says, with respect to the returns that we've charged, which conceal many of the expenditures, they falsely stated that no political campaign expenditures were ever made during those years. So what happens here? He mentions the word political three times. The second time, talking extemporaneously to you, he leaves out the word campaign. And Mr. Jacobs stands up and says, Mr. Pease didn't know that it's limited to campaign activity. And look at this. But better yet, look at the indictment. If we look at the indictment, on page 119, this is the Citizens Alliance charge. What does the indictment say? February 2007. Fumo and Arnao used over $250,000 of Citizens Alliance money to pay for political polling in connection with races in which Fumo was interested. These expenditures were well outside Citizens Alliance mission and violated the legal restrictions on its activities as a non-exempt corporation. And they stand before you and tell you that the government did not know what the rules were. And they have no answer regarding the polling, because, again, they won't show you the polls. which are one campaign poll after another. The only thing Mr. Jacobs suggested on that was, well, some of them are a year before the election, as if people like Ed Rendell and these different senators and John Kerry or Barack Obama wake up the week before an election and say, you know, I want to be a candidate on the ballot next week. You know how campaigns are run in America. You know how long people run for office. And every single one of these polls is for that purpose, is for campaigning. They say that this was done with complete transparency. Those are the words they use over and over. They refused to show the polls to their own accountants, who had to quit because they couldn't complete their assignment. Another one. There are so many of these, and I'm just trying to move quickly, and I'm not going to be able to cover all of them. But this is an interesting one regarding Jamie Spagna. She had a database that was on her computer, and very little attention to it during the trial. And so Mr. Jacobs says, you know, he says, Mr. Fumo told Lenny Lutchko, this is Exhibit 1020, by the way, Mr. Fumo told Lenny Lutchko to put this database on her computer so she could track everything that Citizens Alliance was being buying from Mr. Fumo. Total fabrication. First of all, there was no testimony whether Fumo had any involvement in this at all. Jamie Spagna said there was a time Lutchko put this on her computer. She thought it meant she should keep track of anything she was buying, whoever was buying it. And she quickly realized no one was paying any attention. And she stopped doing it. Now, you can look at it if you want. We really didn't spend any time with it. But if you go through it, it exactly supports her testimony. There are only 169 entries. This goes on for about 60 pages. There are two or three of these on a page. And let's blow up one of them, and you'll see how little information there is. None of them say who purchased anything. All she's doing is writing down what she bought to see if it comes in. Because, of course, at this point, they don't really care. If citizens can pay for it, Ms. Arnell tells her to have citizens pay for it. She uses a different credit card, use a different credit card. What this exhibit really shows, it really proves, is Senate employees in the office on Senate time are doing personal work for Senator Fumo. This is what went on a massive scale. Of these 169 items, they're all grouped by orders because you can see that many are on the same day. There are only 19 orders in the whole thing. That's how many times she did this. Because as she said, in fact, if you take a look at page 48, are we there? Is this page 48? Here's the first entry on page 48, September 4, 2002. Don't say who ordered it. Next entry, vacuum filters, is January 10, 2000, 4 months later. Next entry on page 48 is May 25, 2004, a year and a half later. That's the database. That's what Mr. Jacobs tells you. They're tracking everything, and of course, it doesn't say anything about Citizens Alliance. If we go back to page 5 here, you'll see many of the 19 orders are not even for citizens. Here's one where it says there's a Fuji camera being bought. And I can tell you, you can look at 1015 and 1016. That's not paid for by citizens. There's another page here where a Sims game is purchased by Mr. Lutchko, probably because Mr. Fumo wanted it. That's not paid for by Citizens Alliance. So 19 times they write down something they're ordering. This is what you're told is keeping track. No, they weren't keeping track. They never kept track. There are no records of what Mr. Fumo got from that time. It only took this effort by the FBI to dig everything up and flush out these different defenses that we're hearing now. Same thing with the numbers. You know, we keep hearing that we're accused of voodoo accounting, was I think the term was being used, because we add up these numbers and show what was purchased. You want to see some voodoo accounting? Let me show you. Mr. Jacobs made an effort over and over and over again, going through the different areas, to push down the numbers, to make them smaller. Now, I'm not really sure why he was doing that, because they admit $63,000 in tools and consumer goods, no dispute about the tens of thousands of dollars in furniture bought at Tasker Street, the vehicles. He cuts it in half, but it's still $200,000. The polls, $250,000. As I said, citizens cannot legally do any of this. He cannot do it out of his Senate office. He cannot legally do this for himself without any board, any supervision, any anything. It's all a theft. It's all a fraud. So what difference? They're admitting it. What difference does it make to push down the numbers? I don't know. I leave that to you. And in addition, as you know from the instructions you've heard, the government is not required to prove any particular number. A fraud is a fraud, even if it doesn't succeed. If you make false statements in an effort to get something, you have committed these crimes that are charged here. The government doesn't have to show 1 million, 2 million, 200,000, whatever. Okay, but we go through the exercise. So the first thing Mr. Jacobs does is he plays with the dates. And that's very important here. You've got to focus on the dates. The key, most important date probably is November 16, 2003. That's the first article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And that huge number of changes that starts after that. First there's a check for the bulldozer, then there's a check for snow clearing, and then all these things to try to create defense number one. So, and over again, they ignore that. So Mr. Kogan says, well, we paid for the polls. Or they say, look, in 2004, Mr. Fumo paid for the polling for his own campaign. Well, of course, the investigation was underway. Or we gave a $5,000 check to Wallace, you heard this morning, in September of 2004. You got to keep your eye on the dates, because it explains why they're doing the things they're doing and when they're doing it. And so that came up with the Gazella. Mr. Jacobs has no explanation for the Gazella. You know, I'm not going to do it again. I ridiculed the idea of Citizens Alliance being involved in the art business. I think it is ridiculous, but the evidence certainly supports that. So what does he tell you? He says, well, the prints were the main thing here, and the prints were always part of the deal, to sell prints of this Gazella, apparently, out of the warehouse on Wharton Street. I spent a lot of time belittling the idea that they're waiting for this poor Mr. Stobart to pass on so the painting will go up in value. And so now they say, no, that's not it. It's really the prints. And the prints were always part of the deal. And what does he show you? He shows you a contract dated February 4th of 2004, exactly, when they realized Mr. Fumo cannot have this painting that Citizens Alliance had lined up for him. You've got to keep your eye on the dates. And then he shows the board report from September of 2004. The board is never asked to approve. The money's been spent. Stobart has painted the thing. It's already done. And the board is told for the first time in September of 04, oh, by the way, we commissioned a painting and we're giving it to the Seaport Museum. And these nice, friendly directors who like them sit around and nod, and you know that's how all their meetings go. And they only start having meetings because of the investigation. So that's very important to keep aware of. But then the same thing happens with the farm equipment, the vehicles. Palermo comes up with $37,000. It's really not Palermo's money. It's Steve Marcus's money, but they want to make it look more legitimate because Palermo has some connection with the farm. They're trying to get this stuff off the books of Citizens Alliance while the investigation is going on. So Citizens gets $37,000 back. He takes it off the total. And Mr. Jacobs asks, he says, is there any rule of math that says the rules of subtraction and addition are suspended when an investigation starts? No, there's no rule of math that says that. But there is a rule of logic and a rule of law that says if you pay something back after you got caught, you're not getting brownie points for that. And that's what's happening here. They are caught, and they're trying to conceal it by giving this money back and saying we never stole it. Exhibit 1050, I could spend my remaining minutes on Exhibit 1050 because so many things were said about it. Mr. Jacobs endeavored to cut it in half. First thing he did was he lopped off the insurance problem. Take out $93,000. Why? Because Citizens Alliance, according to its grants, is allowed to insure vehicles. In fact, that's how he cuts in half what's on our grant chart, where we say, here are the grant checks that were used to buy things for Mr. Fumo. Well, of course Citizens Alliance is allowed to insure vehicles. But we're talking about these vehicles. This is a limited number of vehicles that are for Mr. Fumo, where he has two or three at a time. He's got the luxury minivan down the shore. He's got, and I guess by saying luxury minivan, they're going to say that I'm demonizing it. That's what this case is about. They never talked about the nature of the vehicles that I talked about. It says everything about the fraud. The Cadillac Escalade, the Town and Country, the $55,000 Lincoln Navigator that's purchased. You can't talk about this case without talking about these things. It's all about the greed, and that's the reason that they committed these offenses. But the insurance, for example, when the grant is paying for the insurance for the Town and Country or for the Escalade, these are vehicles that are not even owned by Citizens. Remember, they've put these in the name of Eastern Leasing, a for-profit company. The grant can't pay this insurance for vehicles owned by a separate for-profit company. Now, of course, in the defense closing, they didn't even talk about the whole for-profit thing, which is another fraud all itself, which is creating these for-profits for no purpose other than taking these things off the books of Citizens Alliance and off of the publicly filed 990. So the whole insurance thing, $93,000 disappears, you know, for no reason whatsoever. And then with regard to he cuts $100,000 off the cost by saying, oh, but wait a second, there was a blue book value here. they, at the end of all this, they still own the Town and Country and the Escalade and the Jeep. And if you look those up in the Blue Book, that's $101,000 in value as of 2005, and we should take that off this chart. No, they know better than that. The Jeep Grand Cherokee that's purchased here, they traded in the Town and Country and the Escalade for that. The reason it's a negative number, they not only got a Jeep Grand Cherokee, they got $4,000 back from the dealer because the value of the two things they traded in was more than the value of the brand new Jeep Grand Cherokee. So the only Blue Book value you're left with, if you really want to play this game of giving credit for things that are done after the investigation started, is the $18,000 Blue Book value of the Jeep. I'm not positive that number. I believe that's what it was, but that's in the ballpark. You want to talk about strange accounting. And so then when he's done, when he's cut off $100,000 in insurance, $100,000 in value for no reason, he says, what are we left with? $200,000, $20,000 a year for 10 years. And he shows the list of drivers, Exhibit 1063A. He says there are 15 drivers driving these vehicles, a $20 million company, and they've got these vehicles, and they're spending $20,000 a year. No. It's just one misrepresentation of the testimony after another. That's not what these drivers are driving, the people who are listed here. We're listing on Exhibit 1050 the vehicles that Ms. Arnao and Mr. Fumo got, and Mr. Fumo's drivers. Citizens Alliance and these drivers have all sorts of other vehicles. And you can see it if you look at the insurance records, that big box. They've got pickup trucks and dump trucks and bucket trucks and garbage trucks, and it's all insured under these policies, and that's why these drivers are on this policy. Like I said, I could keep going, but let me move along. The next subject that Mr. Jacobs got into, and this was sort of his showpiece, was about the grant chart, and of course I have to talk about that. This is where the real assault on my colleagues started. This is where Mr. Jacobs says it's a crime. The government's committing a crime. It's a fraud. It's startling. It's shameful. He says that the government attorneys and the government agents really occupy a world that I'm sure none of us want to occupy, where they apparently get up in the morning with venom, he said, with venom coursing through their veins and decide, what evidence are we going to manufacture in order to go convict this innocent person that we're targeting, as opposed to addressing the real issues in the community. This is the world that they imagine. And what is the example of this? What shows this absolutely heinous conduct by the government representatives that you've seen here in the courtroom? What shows it? The grant chart. That's what shows it, this Exhibit 1045. It is all smoke and diversion. And I'm going to explain to you really briefly, if you even need another explanation, of what the grant chart is all about. The strategy here that's being used is as obvious as it's reprehensible. And it is, if you can't defend the case on the facts, attack the messenger, attack the government, and accuse the government of engaging in criminal conduct. Mr. Jacobs cites all these accounting rules that he says Agent Niccolo did not follow. You heard FASB and GAAP and whatever. And the only time you ever heard that was from Mr. Jacobs. There's no evidence in this case of any accounting rules that apply to any of this. These charts add up numbers, like Mr. Niccolo told you they do. You want to know how much they got in vehicles? Add it up. You want to know what the bulldozer cost? There it is. You want to know how much mahogany furniture and all the other things they didn't talk about from Casper Street? You want to know what that costs? Here's a list. That's what's in this case. But no, he has to make it sound as if we're violating every rule. And then we get to Exhibit 1045. What happened with Exhibit 1045, the grant chart? Again, in the opening statement, you heard defense number two for the first time. Defense number two being, I'm a fundraiser. I did this brilliant litigation against PICO. And so I could take money, a cut as a fundraiser. And not only that, I didn't take the 24% cut that everybody else can get. I just took this small amount in goods and services. When this opening statement was made, and Agent Niccolo and the others heard it for the first time, the statement was also made by the defense lawyers that, and this is all private money. That's where we get this concept of private PICO money. Nothing I took was grant money. In fact, Mr. Kogan even repeated that in his argument. He even said in his closing argument, everything Mr. Fumo got is private money. It's not true. grant money was paying for those vehicles long before anybody ever thought of the PICO litigation. But that's a side point. So what Agent Niccolo explained to you is pretty obvious, which is we don't really care where the money came from that Mr. Fumo took, because as I've told you over and over and over again, he can't do this, and he can't do it through fraud. It can be private money. It can be public money. What matters is it's Citizens Alliance money. But you pique our curiosity. You say that none of what he got that we've alleged in all our exhibits came from grant money. Let's take a look. And so Exhibit 1045 is created. And sure enough, there's over $60,000 worth of payments listed on other charts that came from grant checks. And Exhibit 1045 has never been challenged in any way. There's never been a question raised about the accuracy of this chart and everything that is listed on it. So what happens? Mr. Niccolo is testifying, and Mr. Jacobs cross-examines him. And he says, well, wait a second. Didn't Citizens Alliance transfer money in from non-grant accounts that would cover all of this money? And in fact, Mr. Jacobs already had the defense exhibit. He tried to suggest differently to you. They already had a chart prepared by their accountant, you might remember. I think it was Exhibit 726 at the time. And he showed Mr. Niccolo the chart that showed $130,000 or something more coming in. And Niccolo looked at the chart and said, no, I know that more money went out of the grant accounts than came back in when they were transferring money back and forth. And I'm sure you remember, you came back after a lunch break, and we had run out and created these two new summaries, 1046 and 1047, to show some of the transfers out that Mr. Niccolo was talking about that were not on the defense chart, and they included these checks to Vanguard. So the game continues. So what happens? Ms. Busby, the accountant, testifies in the defense case. And she introduces Defense Exhibit 730, if we were able to bring that up on the screen. And now she's added the fourth column because she's covering all of the charts. She still has a roughly similar number of $134,000 more coming back from Citizens Alliance, and that's their defense to this. But what's happening? She's leaving off $499,000 that goes the other way. Now they say, we don't look at both sides of a transaction. Look at this. She puts on a different page, the next page, the $499,000 that goes the other way. What's the justification? Well, we know what these things are for. We know that this specifically reimbursed certain expenses when the grant transferred this money out. So they go back to their previous page and they say, this means that anything else that came in is covering the grant checks. Well, it doesn't prove anything. These grant checks that are on Exhibit 1045, these were written over a period of several years. All of it, years before the big transfers came back from Citizens Alliance. There's no proof in this case whatsoever that any record was kept showing why that money came back. At the end of the day, Mr. Niccolo is absolutely right that more money went out of the grant than came back in. And everybody is right that we will never know the final answer as to why those last transfers came back. Why? Because they don't keep records of anything relating to Senator Fumo, if this really relates to Senator Fumo, which gets us back to defense number one and the effort to conceal this from everybody. That's the story of this grant chart. And on that story, Mr. Jacobs tells you that Agent Niccolo, the prosecutor, the government, committed a crime. Mr. Jacobs tells you that this alone is reasonable doubt, even though it doesn't address in the least what really matters, which is Citizens Alliance, through any account, is buying all this stuff from Senator Fumo without disclosing it out of his Senate office, all this stuff he's not permitted to do. This is really absurd. But this is, and we've seen it over and over as I've gone through the argument, this is what you argue when you have nothing else to argue and when the evidence in the case is as overwhelming as it is in this case. Let me move on and wrap up with the Seaport Museum and talking about the obstruction charges. Seaport Museum, very brief argument from Mr. Kogan this morning. Again, just trying to show you little pieces of the controlling documents, leaving out what's explicit, what every director testified. You heard from three prominent members of the community who are members of the board of directors of the Independent Seaport Museum, McCausland, Miggs, D'Alessio. Everyone told you Fumo cannot get free trips on these yachts. He has to tell us. We would not approve it. No one else did it. You can't do it. Open, shut. That's what it's about. And the fraud is they don't disclose what they're required to disclose. Mr. Kogan says It's a dictatorship. John Carter is the dictator of the Independent Seaport Museum, can do whatever he wants. He says that the board members are, this is honorary. You saw D'Alessio and McCausland, the board chairman. You heard the work they do, the meetings they attend, the money they themselves give. This is not, ladies and gentlemen, Citizens Alliance. These fellows, in their treatment of their fiduciary duty, are not John Cifrisi and Jeff Travellina and the other people that you met from the board of Citizens Alliance. They operate the corporation, as it says in the board, in their bylaws, and in their articles of incorporation, and in their ethics policy. And there's simply no defense. They still won't, you know, Mr. Krogman still tries to suggest that maybe Senator Fumo was doing some development. No. The counts in the indictment, as I said before, it's 2002, 2003. These are pleasure cruises. They've been pleasure cruises for years. That's all they are, with the same people. There's no development going on. But I can't resist commenting that he pointed out that the only major money that Senator Fumo influenced, that he apparently brought in, involved the Board of City Trusts, and he said that that was private money because it came from the Girard estate. And this is a matter of public record. He can talk about Henry VIII and whatever. Let me talk about a little history. That was private money in 1830. Stephen Girard, who was a very important man in the early history of this city, died in 1830. And when he died in 1830, what he did with his private money was he left it
objected
to the city
to.
Of Philadelphia.
Objected
and there was
to.
Testimony about that.
Objected to. That's not in evidence.
Well, that's going to be a matter for the jury to decide. I'm not quite sure myself, and that's why we have a jury. You may continue with your argument.
There was testimony that these trusts were left to the city and are administered by various public officials. The treasurer of the Board of City Trusts is the treasurer of the city of Philadelphia. And you heard that in the evidence when we addressed that. And this is what he's taking credit for and going out and taking free cruises. And the board members told you, no, you can't do it. That even if he did do this, even if he did bring in money, you don't get anything free. That's doing your job as a director. And it's a pro bono job. It's a job for which there's no compensation. The only time that you are on the yachts for development is when you're doing development on the yacht, when you're treating people then and there and you're encouraging them to contribute. You don't get this as a reward, gift, income, compensation, perk. In the same way, he can't get anything from Citizens Alliance. They follow the rules. And that board resolution, of course, says the same thing, that they follow the rules. Let's conclude talking about the obstruction counts. First, with regard to Ms. Arnao. Mr. Jacobs tries to lump Ms. Arnao together with the various other people whose computers were wiped, saying she's in with this large group of people. What's so different about her? Well, first of all, we're not required to prove that there's anything different about her. We've elected who to charge, but I think you know exactly what's different about her. She is the executive director of an organization that received a subpoena that specifically called for the production of email. And she repeatedly allowed the computers of that organization to be wiped. Mr. Jacobs never addressed the testimony of Don Wilson, who told you that he went in, along with Lutchko, wiped the computers at Citizens. You saw the forensic evidence of it. And he explained to Ms. Arnao what he was doing and what it was. That she knew what was going on, because remember, when the FBI got her PC card, when they finally went in and imaged both the desktop computer at Citizens and the PC card on February 10th of 2005, that when they did that, there was nothing there. That she had, you know, one of the agents I think called it junk, that there was nothing was more than a month old, that it was all mostly jokes and spam. And now, you know, a person knows the contents of their email folders and their computer. She knows everything has been systematically wiped. She has allowed the records of her organization to be destroyed. Why? In furtherance of this effort to protect her and her patron. Now Mr. Jacobs' other point was that he said that, we had a couple other points. One was that, you know, what about these emails that are discovered that are actually somewhat incriminating? Well, that's interesting. Mr. Lutchko, as he's wont to do, and you see this a number of times throughout the case, made a mistake. Mr. Lutchko went in on January 26th of 2005. This is everything's hitting the fan. On the 19th and 20th, the government is demanding, where is the email? Here's another subpoena. And on January 26th, Lutchko goes into Citizens and runs a scan. He knows he's run a wipe, but now he's looking to see, is there anything left, anything new that's been created that I need to worry about? And there's not. And so nothing further happens. But after he does that, on the same day, actually, on January 26th, two more emails are sent by Lutchko. The one said is another reminder to delete everything, and he's sending it to citizens as well as everywhere else. And there's another about a PST file, I think, and then he sends another one on January 28th. And that's where he forgets those are going to be sitting there, and sure enough, they are on February 10th. Now, does this absolve Ruth Arnao? No, she has turned over her computer to Lenny Lutchko and Don Wilson. That's why you saw the email, Exhibit, I think, 1563, that was never shown during the defense closing, where Lillian Kozo is reminding them, when you go to citizens, don't tell anybody where you're going. I call that a smoking gun email because that direction obviously comes from Mr. Fumo. It's not coming from Lillian Kozo. And, of course, they don't address that in any of their remarks. But with respect to Ms. Arnao, the most important thing is Exhibit 1555. This is on January 21 of 2005. It's not on Ms. Arnao's PC card. We have it because, as with so many other relevant emails, Lutchko kept it. He kept it in his own records and only deleted things between himself and Mr. Fumo. So we have this with Ms. Arnao, and it settles the case. Mr. Kogan, in his argument, when he was arguing the obstruction part of the case to you, he said that this case, quote, the evidence is clear, the evidence is unambiguous. And he said that to you while not showing you one key email after another, especially from this January-February time period. Remember, now just as an aside, it's up to you as to how much evidence you look at. It's not going to be fun for any of us to sit around waiting for you, but we're going to wait for you. And it's up to you as to how much evidence you want to review. But we invite you, if you have any question, to look at every piece of evidence. It all tells a story. If you take any section of the case, which is outlined in the government's exhibit list, look at what survived. It's not everything. It never will be, because there was such a massive effort to delete evidence. But look at what we have, and you'll see why each of the charges is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense does not want you to do that. And that's why, for example, with Jerry Sable, Mr. Kogan shows one email that says, I will not let you use taxpayer money to work on the farm, and leaves out the five emails that come after it that show that the minute Dugalecki's attention is turned elsewhere, Mr. Fumo is back to having Sable work on the farm and enlisting Charlie Shoulders to get going because Sable's about to retire. With regard to any email they focus on, look at the broad picture and you see things like this. This was not shown to you. What happens with Ruth Arnao? The minute that the heat turns up, she goes and meets with Lenny Lutchko, her co-conspirator, and said, after our conversation yesterday, Lutchko says, I've been giving your situation some thought. He reviews with her the wipe that he has run and tells her everything that is wiped. Now, I would like to do the same thing to your computers at home and the shore, but you're going to have to let me know if it is okay. And what happens? He does it. You know that on February 11, 2005, her computer at the shore is wiped in her condominium, her private residence, presumably locked, where she either let Mr. Lutchko in or gave him a key. The obstruction case against Ms. Arnao really begins and ends with this email that you were not shown. Now, Mr. Jacobs asked, he said, well, Johnson and Shepard and Sprague, the lawyers, they're being told that nothing is being lost. Lutchko be telling the same thing to Ms. Arnao. Well, you see it here in black and white. This is the summary that he's relying on. The December 2004 entry on their chronology that they did at the Sprague Law Firm. Now, they testify that date's wrong. They realize that date should be January 21, 2005. They were asking questions of Lutchko at this moment for the same reason, because this subpoena had showed up the day before. And he told them, and this is what they reported to Sprague, was that, yes, he does wipes, but everything is backed up on PC cards. That's what he told them. Here's where you see a conspiracy in action. This is totally consistent with what you know about Mr. Fumo never telling the full story to Mr. Sprague or his lawyers about what's happening. They're not filling in the lawyers on what they're doing because they know that what they're doing is wrong, and they don't want to be told otherwise. So on the very same day, Lutchko tells Johnson and Shepard, that everything's preserved, don't worry, I back it up, and I do a wipe, but it's on the backup. On the very same day, he tells Ms. Arnao this, here are the wipes that I've done, and now I want to do it on your computer, at your home, and at the shore. This is how a conspiracy works, and this is what you see very, very clearly. And of course, the wipe gets done. That's what the evidence here is about. Do a few emails survive? Yes. Are there some printed emails? He'd like you to think that Ms. Arnao knew that 8 scattered emails were left behind in her drawers on Tasker Street and in the boxes that her lawyers produced at Citizens Alliance. I leave that up to you. Obviously, you had this massive effort to destroy all of their evidence, and that's exactly what they did. And then we get to the obstruction charges against Mr. Fumo. The evidence is clear. He admitted it. He orchestrated this effort to delete evidence, and he kicked it up when the FBI investigation started because he didn't want them to have it. And the whole defense for him comes down to this advice of counsel defense. But remember what I said, and no one talked about it on the defense side. There are legal requirements that the judge instructed you on. To have an advice of counsel defense, there has to be a showing that full disclosure was made to the lawyers and that it was made before the conduct took place. They made no effort to justify that and fit it with the judge's instructions because they can't. The wiping and the deleting was going on long before that conversation with Scandone. And, of course, it was never disclosed in any way to Mr. Sprague. So what do they rely on now? Well, it comes down to these notes that were created by Jeff Johnson. And this is fascinating. Let's bring this up on the screen, and I'll also go to the blow-up here. This is really, really interesting, what you're being told. What we see on the notes from Mr. Johnson, now remember, this is January 21, 2006. So this is 2 years later. And one of the interesting things about this is it doesn't say anywhere here that, hey, Dick, Mr. Sprague, you told me 2 years ago that anything that's not under subpoena, I don't have to have. If Mr. Sprague had really said that, then don't you think that would have been the discussion with Mr. Sprague? How are we going to get your advice of counsel into the case that you gave me? That's interesting to start and tells you that Mr. Fumo gets the worst of this argument as to when that was made up. It was obviously made up later. What happens here is this leads to Scandone because that's what they're working on at this point in time. But they're not there yet. So at first it says, VJF always believed no obligation to save anything until you get a subpoena. RAS did as well. Thus, if VJF got an email saying they were cleaning up stuff, VJF didn't think it was a problem. Now, Mr. Sprague says, and Mr. Johnson, you have to conclude that both lawyers are lying to you. What they both say is, this does not mean that they're telling him that you never have an obligation to save things until you get a subpoena. And again, what happens here when they address their testimony? They misstate the testimony. They say, oh, they said we were joking about some other lawyer who didn't know it. It wasn't RAS did as well. We're joking about another lawyer who didn't know it. Why are they making up testimony for you? This was just 2 weeks ago. What they said was very clear in explaining what Johnson said were never meant to be detailed notes. Johnson told you he's not writing everything down, but both he and Sprague told you what's going on here. They're talking about a new statute. They're talking about Section 1519. And Section 1519, what says that not only do you not have to have a subpoena, in order you are guilty of obstruction of justice if you even anticipate an agency investigation by the FBI or the IRS before the investigation begins, before any subpoena is issued. And Mr. Sprague candidly told you he did not know that at the time they had this meeting. And that's what this is referring to. There's no joking going on here. And I don't know why they're suggesting to you that there is. Mr. Sprague testified, I didn't know that the law had been broadened. And I don't think many other lawyers knew it. And then they talked about a lawyer at a conference who didn't know it. That's what they're addressing here. And then Johnson, we heard, brought the conversation back to reality and said, well, none of that matters here because we're not dealing with a case where the investigation is just anticipated. There was always an investigation underway when all the deletions were going on. But keep reading here. This is where it gets really interesting. VJF view on citizen subpoena. Citizens' records couldn't be touched. Now, that's an interesting one, because how then does he explain that he is deleting citizens' records and sending his people to do it? Put that aside. On his own email, never thought about it. Now, wait a second. Haven't we heard over and over again that Bob Scandone was in his office, showed him the subpoena, said, what does this mean for me? Scandone said, business as usual. What's going on here? On his own email, never thought about it. And then when you continue in these notes on this page, he has more statements here that are really interesting. Never told Luchko to go through and clean up citizens. They're developing the defense right here. Has no memory of any instruction of wiping BlackBerries, even though it's right there in that email that you've seen many times. VJF believed that there would be no reason to wipe BlackBerries. And of course, that's what they kept doing. It says down here, didn't know PGP does wipes, when of course he's been sending his people to do one wipe after another. He's trying out with his lawyers various defenses. But here's the interesting part. This is January 21st of 2006. We heard that this was a two-part meeting, that it started at Sprague's house, and they were having a broad discussion of all the emails and all the obstruction and what they were going to do about it, how they were going to address it, really having the conversation that ultimately led to this trial. And at that meeting, what Mr. Fumo says is, never gave any thought to his own email. The meeting continued 6 days later, on January 27th, at Sprague's office, and you saw the sign-in. And it was there that Mr. Fumo said, what if I had a lawyer who gave me that advice? And he calls Scandone, and you have that famous walk in the park, where they go out in Rittenhouse Square to talk about what Mr. Fumo wants Mr. Scandone to do. And Scandone tells him, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. You see exactly what was going on here. Mr. Fumo had 6 days to think about it. His discussion did not go well in terms of developing a defense with Mr. Sprague. And he comes back and suddenly says, what if I had a lawyer? We go from, on his own email, never thought about it, to, I had this conversation, business as usual. That's the quality of the advice of counsel defense that's been presented to you in this case. There was no advice of counsel under the law. There was never full disclosure of anything that was happening. The only things he forwarded or kept were the things that were carefully suggested, carefully picked, in order to create the opposite impression of what was happening, while he was just wholesale deleting and having his people delete. And of course, the most important thing is Citizens Alliance. If you have a question about anything of the obstruction, there's no explanation for the deletion that goes on at Citizens Alliance. Only 100 emails left, most of it junk, most of it spam, almost none of it more than a month old. Their records wiped out at the same time that they're running a $20 million business. How does that happen? No advice of counsel there. They're under subpoena. No question here about subpoenas. How does it happen? It happens because Mr. Luchko is sent over with Don Wilson by Mr. Fumo to go get it done. And even Mr. Kogan, in his closing, apparently could not bring himself that far to say what I ridiculed in my closing, the idea that Mr. Luchko would do any of this on his own, would do any of this for no reason, to just walk over to Citizens Alliance that he otherwise has nothing to do with in order to wipe out records. That's the crime here. And the crime is that Ms. Arneo let him do it, let them do this to her computer in order to try to protect herself and Mr. Fumo. And none of this, by the way, answers the question that I asked at the beginning of my closing, which is whether it's legal or not. Why obstruct? Why are they doing this? They're doing this because they don't want the government to be able to prove anything about Citizens Alliance, about the fraud on the Senate, about the Seaport Museum, and all the other stuff that we've talked about. The Exhibit 1555, they don't talk about. Exhibit 1572, Luchko tells Mr. Fumo on February 11th, I am going to the shore to wipe the computers at Monmouth. Exhibit 1576, he tells Mr. Fumo, this is the good, loyal employee. I wiped the computers. I took care of it. They never mention Mark Eisner, poor Mark Eisner, who does nothing but follow instructions. Mark Eisner is the one who told you the most interesting thing. He said, why are these emails sent to all these people? Why are you making an announcement to the staff in Harrisburg? Why are these emails going out in Philadelphia? And he told you, these are the people you have to tell. These are the people who you need to know if you're going to delete Mr. Fumo's email so that nobody can have this evidence. He stands convicted. Why? Because he did this for Mr. Fumo, just like Lenny Luchko did. So we wrap it up. We end where we began. Mr. Pease began long ago in October, and he told you what this case was about, and the government has proven what he described for you. He told you that this was a case about greed, power, and an overwhelming sense of entitlement. And that's exactly what it is. It's not about demonizing anybody. Nobody's happy to be here. These are important people who did important things. They did good things, but they broke the law. And that is the reason we're here. The evidence shows that they used state employees on state time, like Ms. Spagna and Ms. Arneo, paying large salaries to be at Mr. Fumo's beck and call, to do this personal political work that state law explicitly says cannot be done. That friends like Rubin and Palermo are paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. Why? Because they're his friends. That's the reason that outrage happens. You have employees like Don Wilson and Dan Coyne who are being used for, again, just for these personal and political things. People like Cozzo and Sweat, Nelson, Pacello, Cortulo, that tight staff at Tasker Street who are grossly overpaid in violation of every rule and law of the Senate for their loyalty and their willingness to do all the things that you heard about that are personal and political. You have the use of the money and the personnel of this nonprofit charity being run out of a Senate office, being used for the benefit of the senator and the other Senate aide who is running this nonprofit. The fraud on the Seaport Museum, this feverish effort to destroy evidence so that the FBI cannot see the evidence. Mr. Fumo said in his testimony that his only obligation as a senator was to go to Harrisburg and to vote. Well, that was not his only obligation. He had an obligation to follow the law. He had an obligation not to use public office to enrich himself, not to use other people's money in order to shower himself with goods and services and run political campaigns when those other people are taxpayers or are the fund or come from the funds of a nonprofit charitable organization that he funds through his Senate efforts and he runs through his Senate office. The fact of the matter here, ladies and gentlemen, is you did have people who had these significant jobs, but they just lost sight of the borderline between their public positions and their personal needs. They completely lost sight of the line between right and wrong, and that's why we're here. We're here because they committed specific offenses that are listed in the indictment that you're going to see and the indictment that you're going to cast judgment on. They committed those offenses, and that's what they should be held responsible for. They should be found guilty of the charges that were presented against them. I want to thank you again most profoundly for your attention. I greatly appreciate it, and we await your verdict.
All right, members of the jury, we'll take a brief break.
I'll do it. Judge.
Just be quiet up there, Dennis.
Did you decide what you're doing with the
indictment? Please be seated, everybody.
Did you decide what you're doing with the indictment?
We're going to talk about that after the jury goes out.
Okay.
The other matter, did you get my instructions?
No, I just...
Oh, we can give them now. Okay. Here's the copy of my closing instructions. I think you've already seen them. And I will be back in about 10 minutes.
Okay? Okay, Judge.
Okay.
What is now is that?
Now, I have a confession to make, and that is that probably like all of you, I'm tired. And that's why I'm sitting up here, which I'd much rather be standing. I feel more comfortable talking to you that way, but I'm sitting. You may have heard of the concept of saving the best till last. Well, I'm sorry to tell you that this really isn't the best part of the trial, the judge's instruction. In fact, I've never heard anybody refer to it as the best part of the trial. But it is the last speech you will hear, and it's the shortest one you will hear. Now, you've been on what metaphorically I would describe as a long trip. much longer than I expected. And thanks to your great and splendid cooperation and diligence, the trip has been smooth, relatively speaking. This has also been made possible, in my judgment, by the professional conduct of counsel for all parties here, who throughout this trial have acted in the finest tradition of vigorous advocacy on behalf of their clients. It has been an interesting trip, I think, for the most part, although somewhat tedious, and along the way, we've had some laughs. And laugh's a good thing. It's good for all of us to laugh. And in fact, during your deliberations, as you reflect back on some of the things that happened during the trial, you might laugh. But as you know, we have come at last to the serious, very serious phase of this trial, and that is your deliberations. Now, members of the jury, you have daunting tasks or duties before you, but it is well within your ability to carry out those duties. You have seen and heard all the evidence and the arguments of the lawyers, and I have previously instructed you as to law regarding the elements of the offenses charged, a copy of which each of you will receive later tomorrow. The duties I am referring to are twofold. Your first duty is to decide the facts from the evidence that you have heard and seen in the court during this trial. That is your job and your job alone. I play no part in finding the facts, and you should not take anything I may have said or done during the trial as indicating what I think of the evidence or what I think about what your verdict should be. Now, your second duty is to apply the law that I gave to you to the facts that you find after a careful consideration of all the evidence. Your verdict, as you know, has to be unanimous. All of you will have to agree on it, or there will be no verdict. In the jury room, you will discuss the case among yourselves, but ultimately each of you will have to make up his or her own mind. This is a responsibility that each of you has and cannot avoid. Perform these duties fairly and impartially. Do not allow sympathy, prejudice, fear, or public opinion to influence you. You should also not be influenced by any person's race, color, religion, national ancestry, gender, profession, occupation, celebrity, economic circumstances, or position in the life or in the community. You must make your decision in this case based only on the evidence that you saw and heard in the courtroom. Do not let rumors, suspicions, or anything else that you may have seen or heard outside of the court influence your decision in any way. The evidence from which you are to find the facts consists of the following. First of all, obviously, the testimony of the witnesses. Secondly, documents and other things received as exhibits. Third, any fact or testimony that was stipulated, that is formally agreed to by the parties. In this case, the parties have agreed regarding what the testimony of various persons would be if called as a witness. And you should consider such stipulated testimony in the same way as if it had been given in court by the witness. Fourth, certain charts and summaries have been offered by the parties and were admitted as evidence. In some instances, the supporting documents were introduced, while in others, the supporting documents were not admitted in evidence. Charts are admitted as an aid in summarizing a large amount of evidence. The believability of what is set forth in a chart is based on whether you believe that the documents or other matters received in evidence supports the conclusions on the chart. You may use all of these charts and summaries as evidence, giving them whatever weight you see fit. Now, the following things are not evidence. First of all, the indictment itself is not evidence of any kind. It merely describes the charges against Mr. Fumo and Ms. Arneo. It is an accusation only. With respect to indictment, you will notice that it states that charges were committed on or about certain dates. The government does not have to prove with certainty the exact date of an alleged offense. It is sufficient if the government proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the offense was committed on a date reasonably near the date alleged. Now, the second matter that is not evidence, statements and arguments of lawyers for the parties in this case are not evidence. Third, questions by the lawyers, including questions in which the lawyer inserted facts and questions that I might have asked, are not evidence. Objections by lawyers, including objections in which the lawyer stated facts, are not evidence. Any testimony I struck or told you to disregard is not evidence. And, of course, finally, anything you may have heard or seen about this case outside the courtroom is not evidence. You should use your common sense in weighing the evidence. Consider it in light of your everyday experience with people and events, and give it whatever weight you believe it deserves. If your experience and common sense tells you that certain evidence reasonably leads to a conclusion, you certainly may reach that conclusion. Although the lawyers may have called your attention to certain facts or factual conclusions that they thought were important, what the lawyer said is not evidence, and it is not binding on you. It is your own recollection and interpretation of the evidence that controls your decision in this case. Also, again, do not assume from anything I may have done or said during the trial that I have an opinion about any of the issues in this case or about what your verdict should be. Now, there are two types of evidence to be used in any trial, direct evidence and circumstantial evidence, or indirect evidence. You may use both types of evidence in reaching your verdict. Direct evidence is simply evidence which, if believed, directly proves a fact. An example, direct evidence occurs when a witness testifies about something that the witness knows from his or her own senses, something the witness has seen, touched, heard, or smelled. Circumstantial evidence is evidence which, if believed, indirectly proves a fact. For example, a person's state of mind may be proved by circumstantial evidence. It is evidence that proves one or more facts from which you could reasonably find or infer the existence of some other fact or facts. A reasonable inference is simply a deduction or conclusion that reason, experience, and common sense lead you to make from the evidence. A reasonable inference is not a suspicion or a guess. It is a reasoned, logical decision to find that a disputed fact exists on the basis of another fact or facts. For example, if someone walked into the courtroom right now wearing a wet raincoat and carrying a wet umbrella, that would be circumstantial or indirect evidence from which you could reasonably find or conclude that it was raining. You would not have to find that it was raining, but you could. When speaking of circumstantial evidence, I mentioned that a person's state of mind may be proved indirectly or by circumstantial evidence. Often, the state of mind with which a person acts at any given time simply cannot be proved directly, because one cannot read another person's mind and tell what he or she is thinking. However, a defendant's state of mind can be proved indirectly from the surrounding circumstances. Thus, to determine a player's state of mind at a particular time, you may consider evidence about what he or she said, what he or she did or failed to do, how he or she acted, and all the other facts and circumstances shown by the evidence that may prove what was in his or her mind at the time. It is entirely up to you to decide what the evidence presented during the trial proves or fails to prove about a defendant's state of mind. Sometimes different inferences may be drawn from the same set of facts. The government may ask you to draw one inference, and the defense may ask you to draw another. You and you alone decide what reasonable inferences you will draw based on all the evidence and your reason, experience, and common sense. You should consider all the evidence that is presented in the case, direct and circumstantial. The law makes no distinction between the weight that you should give to either direct or circumstantial evidence. It is for you to decide how much weight you wish to give any evidence. I want to speak now about credibility of witnesses. In deciding what the facts are, you must decide what testimony you believe and what testimony you do not believe. You are the sole judges of credibility of the witnesses. Credibility refers to whether a witness is worthy of belief. Was the witness truthful? Was the witness's testimony accurate? You may believe everything the witness says, or only part of it, or none of it. You may decide whether to believe a witness based on his or her behavior and manner of testifying, the explanation the witness gave, and all other evidence in the case, just as you would in any important matter where you are trying to decide if a person is being truthful. In deciding the question of credibility, remember to use your common sense, your good judgment, and your experience. In deciding what factors to believe, you may consider a number of factors, which over the years we have compiled for your consideration. First of all is the opportunity and ability of the witness to see or hear or know the things about which the witness testified. Second is the quality of the witness's knowledge, understanding, and memory. Third is the witness's appearance, behavior, and manner while testifying. Fourth is whether the witness has an interest in the outcome of the case or any motive, bias, or prejudice. Fifth, any relation the witness may have with a party in the case and any effect the verdict may have on that witness. Whether the witness said or wrote anything before the trial that was different from the witness's testimony in court. Seventh, whether the witness's testimony was consistent or inconsistent with other testimony that you believe. And finally, any other factors that, based on your experiences in life, you find bear on whether or not a witness should be believed. Now, inconsistencies or discrepancies in a witness's testimony or between the testimony of different witnesses may or may not cause you to disbelieve a witness. Two or more persons witnessing an event may simply see or hear differently. Mistaken recollection, like failure to recall, is a common human experience. In weighing the effect of an inconsistency, you should also consider whether it was about a matter of importance or an insignificant detail. You should also consider whether the inconsistency was innocent or intentional. You are not required to accept the testimony even if the testimony was not contradicted and the witness was not impeached. You may decide that the witness is not worthy of belief because of the witness's bearing and demeanor or because of the inherent improbability of the testimony or for other reasons that are sufficient to you. After you make your own judgment about the believability of a witness, you can then attach to that witness's testimony the importance or weight that you think it deserves. The weight of the evidence to prove a fact does not necessarily depend on the number of witnesses who testified or the quantity of evidence that was presented. What is more important than numbers or quantity is how believable the witnesses were and how much weight you think their testimony deserves. Ultimately, in determining the believability of a witness, you must rely on your own experiences and common sense in consultation with your fellow jurors. Now, I want to speak to you about the credibility of issues who had plea agreements or were immunized. You have heard evidence from two witnesses, Howard Kane and Mark Eisler, who were alleged accomplices of the defendants, say that they participated in some of the crimes charged and have entered a plea agreement with the government. You have heard evidence from other witnesses who received promises from the government that they would not be prosecuted and that their testimony will not be used against them in a criminal case. All this testimony was received in evidence and may be considered by you. The government is permitted to present the testimony of someone who has reached a plea bargain with the government or received immunity, but you should consider the testimony of such witnesses with great care and caution. In evaluating the testimony, this testimony, you should consider these circumstances along with the others I have called to your attention. Whether or not a witness's testimony may have been influenced by an agreement with the government is for you to determine. You may give each witness's testimony such weight as you think it deserves. And let me make one additional point. You must not consider the guilty plea of Howard Kane or Mike Eister as any evidence of either Vincent Fumo's or Ruth Arneo's guilt. Each person's decision to plead guilty was a personal decision about his guilt. Such evidence is offered only to allow you to assess the credibility of the witness, to eliminate any concern that any of the defendants has been singled out for prosecution, and to explain how the witness came to possess detailed first-hand knowledge of the events about which he testified. You may consider a witness's guilty plea only for those purposes. Now, in this case, Ruth Arneo did not testify. A defendant has an absolute constitutional right not to testify. The burden of proof remains with the prosecution throughout the entire trial and never, never shifts to the defendant. The defendant is never required to prove that he or she is innocent. You must not attach any significance to the fact that Ruth Arneo did not testify. You must not draw any adverse inference against her because she did not take the witness stand. Do not consider for any reason at all the fact that Ruth Arneo did not testify. Do not discuss that fact during your deliberations or let it influence your decision in any way. Now, while a defendant has a constitutional right not to testify, if a defendant chooses to testify, he is, of course, permitted to take the witness stand on his own behalf. In this case, Vincent Fumo testified. You should examine and evaluate his testimony just as you would the testimony of any witness. I want to talk to you now about separate consideration of defendants and offenses. Vincent Fumo and Ruth Arneo are each charged with multiple offenses. Each offense is charged in a separate count of the indictment. In some counts, both defendants are charged, in others, only one of the defendants is charged. The number of offenses charged is not evidence of guilt, and this should not influence your decision in any way. You must separately consider the evidence that relates to each offense, and you must return a separate verdict for each offense. For each offense charged, you must decide whether the government has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the charged defendant is guilty of that particular offense. Your decision on one offense, whether guilty or not guilty, should not influence your decision on any of the other offenses charged. Each offense, as I said, should be considered separately. Further, in our system of justice, guilt or innocence is personal and individual. You must separately consider the evidence against each defendant, and you must return a separate verdict for each defendant. For each defendant on each count, you must decide whether the government has proved the particular defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Again, your decision regarding one defendant on each count, whether guilty or not guilty, should not influence your decision regarding the other defendant. Moreover, with respect to any count on which both defendants are charged, you must separately consider the evidence against each defendant and return a separate verdict as to each. Each defendant, as I said many times, should be considered individually. In short, for each defendant on the offense, you must decide whether the government has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the particular defendant is guilty of the particular offense. Your decision on any one defendant or any one offense, whether guilty or not guilty, should not influence your decision regarding any other offense or defendant. Each defendant and each offense should be considered separately. Now, although the government is required to prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, the government is not required to present all possible evidence related to the case or to produce all possible witnesses who might have some knowledge about the facts of the case. In addition, the defendant is not required to present any evidence or produce any witnesses. And that brings me to the penultimate part of my charge, which is a fancy word, the second to the last part of my charge, and that is to instruct you on the three important principles of any criminal trial in this country. They are presumption of innocence, burden of proof, and reasonable doubt. The defendants pled not guilty to the offenses charged. They are presumed to be innocent. Each started the trial with a clean slate, with no evidence against him or her. The presumption of innocence stays with each defendant unless and until the government has presented evidence that overcomes the presumption by convincing you the defendant is guilty of an offense charged beyond a reasonable doubt. The presumption of innocence requires that you find a defendant not guilty unless you are satisfied that the government has proved guilt beyond a reasonable doubt on each particular offense as charged in the separate counts of the indictment. The presumption of innocence means that a defendant has no burden or obligation to present any evidence at all to prove that he or she is not guilty. The burden or obligation of proof is on the government to prove that the defendant is guilty, and this burden stays with the government throughout the entire trial. In order for you to find a defendant guilty of an offense charged, the government must convince you that the defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That means that the government must prove each and every element of an offense charged beyond a reasonable doubt. A defendant may not be convicted based on suspicion or conjecture, but only on evidence proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, proof beyond a reasonable doubt does not mean proof beyond all doubt or to a mathematical certainty. Doubts which reflect nothing but mere possibilities, speculation, or hunch are not reasonable doubts. A reasonable doubt is a fair doubt based on reason, logic, common sense, or experience. It is a doubt that an ordinary reasonable person has after carefully weighing all the evidence, and is a doubt of the sort that would cause him or her to hesitate to act in matters of importance in his or her own life. It may arise from the evidence or from the lack of evidence or from the nature of the evidence. If, having now heard all the evidence, you are convinced that the government proved each and every element of an offense charged beyond a reasonable doubt, you should return a verdict of guilty for that offense. However, if you have a reasonable doubt about one or more of the elements of the offense charged, then you must return a verdict of not guilty of that offense. I told you this would be short, members of the jury. It hasn't even been a half hour. We have one final instruction to you. Let me explain some things about your deliberations in the jury room and your possible verdicts. Now, the first thing you should do, if you haven't already done it, is to choose someone to be your foreperson. This person will speak for the jury here in court. He or she will also preside over your discussions. However, the views and vote of the foreperson are entitled to no greater weight than those of any other juror. Second, I want to remind you again that your verdict, whether it is guilty or not guilty, must be unanimous. To find a defendant guilty of any offense, every one of you must agree that the government has overcome the presumption of innocence with evidence that proves each element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. To find a defendant not guilty of any charge, every one of you must agree that the government has failed to convince you beyond a reasonable doubt. Third, if you decide that the government has proved the defendant guilty, then it will be my responsibility to decide what the appropriate punishment should be. You should never consider the possible punishment in reaching your verdict. Fourth, as I have said before, your verdict must be based only on the evidence received in this case and the law I have given to you. You should not take anything I may have said or done during the trial as indicating what I think of the evidence or what I think your verdict should be. What the verdict should be is your exclusive responsibility. Fifth, now that all the evidence is in, the arguments are completed, and once I have finished these instructions, you are free to talk about the case in the jury room. In fact, it is your duty to talk with each other about the evidence and to make every reasonable effort you can to reach a unanimous verdict. Talk with each other, listen carefully and respectfully to each other's views, and keep an open mind as you listen to what your fellow jurors have to say. Do not hesitate to change your mind if you are convinced that other jurors are right and that your original position was wrong. But do not ever change your mind just because other jurors see things differently or just to get the case over with. In the end, your vote must be exactly that, your own vote. It is important for you to reach unanimous agreement, but only if you can do so honestly and in good conscience. Listen carefully to what the other jurors have to say and then decide for yourself if the government has proved the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, no one will be allowed to hear your discussions in the jury room, and no record will be made of what you say. You should all feel free to speak your minds. Remember, if you elected to take notes during the trial, and I know many of you have, your notes should be used only as a memory aids. You should not give your notes greater weight than your independent recollection of the evidence. You should rely upon your own independent recollection of the evidence or lack of evidence, and you should not be unduly influenced by the notes of other jurors. Notes are not entitled to any more weight than the memory or impression of each juror. Sixth, once you start deliberating, do not talk about this case to court officials, and by court officials, I mean in this case, Mr. Higgins, or to me, or to anyone else except each other. If you have any questions or messages, your foreperson should write them down on a piece of paper, sign them, and give them to the court official, Mr. Higgins in this case, who will give them to me. I will first talk to the lawyers about what you have asked, and I will respond as soon as I can. In the meantime, if possible, continue with your deliberations while you're waiting an answer to the question you posed. If you want to see any of the exhibits that were admitted in evidence that are not among those sent out with you, you must again send me a message, and if I can legally do so, I will have those exhibits provided to you. One more thing about messages. Do not ever write down or tell anyone how you or anyone else voted. That must stay secret until you have finished your deliberations. If you have occasion to communicate with the court while you are deliberating, do not disclose the number of jurors who have voted to convict or acquit on any offense. Now, members of the jury, that is the end of my instructions to you. You're going to be receiving a number of things. Among others, a verdict slip, which is self-explanatory, my instructions both that I gave before the trial before the closing arguments began, and today, and you're going to receive lots of exhibits. I'm going to ask Mr. Higgins to escort the 12 of you who are serving on the jury as regular jurors to the deliberation room. I have a few brief instructions to give the alternate jurors, but don't leave until you say goodbye to them. They're going to be back very shortly to see you. Don't talk with them. Don't deliberate with them. But you're welcome to say goodbye and whatever greetings you might wish to exchange. So now the 12 of you can retire. Ms. Cody and Ms. Fiorelli and Ms. Lane, would you all slip up here a little bit to the front so I... please be seated, everyone. Now, for you three, I'm not going to have the chance to personally thank you and talk to you after the trial, which I like to do. It would not be at all appropriate for me to do that now. Because members of the jury, you three members of the jury, you are still on duty. And you will remain on duty until this jury returns a verdict. But here's the good news. You don't have to report to court at 10 a.m. every day. But while the jury is conducting its deliberations, you must continue to observe all the restrictions that I have instructed you throughout the trial. That is, you must not discuss the case with anyone, including your fellow alternate jurors, the regular jurors, other people involved in the trial, members of your family, friends, or anyone else. Do not speak at all with any of the parties, the witnesses, or the attorneys. Do not permit anyone to discuss the case with you. Do not even remain in the presence of anyone discussing the case. If anyone approaches you and tries to talk to you about the case, please report that to me through Mr. Higgins. Now, do not watch or listen to any news reports concerning this trial on television or radio, or do not read any news accounts of this trial in the newspaper or in the Internet. Do not use the Internet to search for information about the parties, witnesses, lawyers, or anything else associated with this trial. Do not conduct any kind of investigation of your own. Should you be asked to participate in reaching a verdict in this case, should that happen, that you might be needed to participate as a regular juror. The only information you will be allowed to consider in deciding this case is what you learned in the courtroom. So that's why we ask you, until this jury has reached its verdict, to remember all the admonitions I've given you throughout this trial. After they've reached a verdict, then you're free to talk to anybody, okay? And again, thank all three very much. It's been a pleasure having you three here these past 5 months or so. Now you can go back and say goodbye to your fellow jurors. All right, counsel, we have some work to do, I think. Before that, any comments?
Your Honor, I think I have to preserve under Rule 30, I guess it is, our objection to your not giving a good faith instruction on the fraud charge. We have to do that.
I think you have to preserve that. I think maybe you already did, but
we'll have to do it again.
We'll make sure it's preserved. Okay.
And reserve Rule 29s as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Same position, Judge. Same positions.
Oh, yeah, same position. Okay, please be seated, everybody. Counsel, as you know, we have some decisions to make with regard to swearing the marshal. Okay, swearing the marshal. We have to.
Okay.
That's right.
Please raise your right hand. And did you swear that you were well? Sorry.
There you go.
All right, I got it. I'm good. Did you swear that you will keep this jury in some quiet, convenient place for their deliberations, that you will allow no one to speak to them, nor speak to them yourself, touching the issue before them, unless it be to ask if they agreed upon their verdict, so help you God. Thank you.
Okay, now, counsel, we have some matters to take care of. My point is, I don't know what agreement has been reached with regard, first of all, to exhibits. As I told you before, my practice is that whatever you agree upon, of course, goes out. And what you are in disagreement about, I will rule on. So do we have a list of disagreements yet?
We do not, Your Honor. Our position is that the exhibits that the government had obtained, admitted into evidence, should go out with the jury.
Well, that's the usual position, but I always let parties raise any objection they wish to.
I mean, I'm not aware yet of any objection to that.
Okay, then I will give you some time to...
I will discuss see if there's any lingering objection, but as you know, we objected early and often about summary charts. Your Honor said even if they come into evidence, the question then becomes whether you will send them out with the jury.
Yeah, well, I decided with the instruction I gave that pretty well summed up the summary charts, and I would let them use them, both your charts and the charts in government.
And the last question, of course, is the one we've
been concerned about for a long time, and that is what form of the indictment goes in.
Right, and I have not resolved that yet. I'm going to resolve that tonight.
Okay.
Now, the other thing is that I want you to try to work out the technical aspects of this. One of the jurors wanted to come out here and use the screen to put the exhibits on the screen. And I've been advised that that's at least technically possible, but I'm not so sure about how that would work or what your thoughts are on that, if you have any.
What are they working with now? They're going to have a computer screen in their...
Not in there.
Okay, I didn't know whether there's...
No, no.
Okay.
In other words, we can accomplish that technically speaking, but what that would anticipate, counsel, is, and what I plan to do is close off this courtroom, because we can't. They're going to come in here and use these computer screens. I think it's a lot easier for them to do it that way. But on the other hand, if it poses some technical difficulties that you can think of, we won't do that.
I want to ask Mr.
And you don't have to decide today, because you can decide tomorrow morning. But
I'll do it.
Talk it over, and maybe talk it over among all counsel and see if that's at all feasible.
We don't have any objection to it, Your
but
Honor.
I understand that. But that, and I would like to use the courtroom here, because I think for the jury's sake, they would get out of the small room they have and have the ability to walk around. The courtroom would be locked. All exhibits would be taken away.
Your Honor, I'll make a point of getting together with Mr. Thies and Mr. Zausmer first thing tomorrow morning. And
yeah.
We'll work out what we have to work out.
Well, let's make first thing before 10, because the jury's going to come back at 10, and I'd like to, in the ideal world, I'd like to have everything ready for them to start deliberating by 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
So I will be here well before 10, and if there's need for discussions with me, you can come down to my chambers or request that I come up to court. But one thing we are going to do is clear out the courtroom ultimately. So.
Right, Your Honor, as far as exhibits go, how would you like us to leave those in? The exhibits that are going out with the jury.
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, I mean,
we have talked about that. And
I mean, our thought, Your Honor, if you permit it, is that the exhibits that are admitted into evidence, what we've done is the last 2 days, we've removed everything from the boxes that was not admitted into evidence, leaving only the items that are admitted. And you know, our proposal would be to leave in the courtroom only the exhibits that were admitted into evidence, and we've taken everything else out. We've taken all the grand jury transcripts, the 302s, all the exhibits that we didn't use. We're going to finish doing that as soon as we finish.
The 302s in there?
No, the only thing that stays in the courtroom is what has been admitted.
That's right.
As far as the computer is concerned, Your Honor, I think it would require some cooperation from someone in the clerk's office.
I know. It is somewhat fraught with problems, I think. I don't know. We might have to say no to that.
What we can easily do is provide a disk that has all of our admitted exhibits on it, and the defense can do that also. But I think it has to be up, because we can't interact with the jury, it has to be up to the court to provide a computer that they can then use that's hooked up to the...
Process.
Yeah, but I mean, what you're saying is we can't have a court personnel or anybody else in with the jurors. That's what... So this juror person, of course, a lot of them have the skills, certainly have the skills necessary to do that.
It would have to be a clean computer without any internet access.
Yeah.
You please make sure that they get an additional instruction that they may not delete a single one of these things.
Yeah.
Well,
it's
really
a
disk anyway. So
they've got the statute.
It's a backup.
They've got the statute.
Okay.
They'll know it. Your Honor, about the redact.
Anyway, excuse me.
Do you want to hear our view about the redaction of the indictment before you consider it?
If you could look at that first, Judge.
I want to look at it first. Have you haven't redacted anything other than two counts?
We redacted two counts. We also redacted paragraphs that were not.
Oh, okay.
We're not introducing.
Well, then, see, I have the indictment here, and I have to look at it. And I have yours downstairs, and I have theirs downstairs. Here's the indictment.
Right.
That I've had here, except the one day I needed it.
Okay.
Your Honor, see what Mr. Goldberger and Ms. Carabasos have been working. They've been working on. They submitted things.
They submitted things to me. But so tomorrow I will rule on that.
Right, and we have some strong views about it, so we'll be heard
at
the right time.
Yeah, I know you will. So you all
you too. Right.
So we will we'll resolve that tomorrow, and any other problems you have. But my hope, gentlemen, is that we get together about 9 tomorrow. and I'll be available by 9 and get together sometime before 10, between 9 and 9:30, and talk about what the problems are so we can get the jury working okay.
Now, as far as the schedule, Your Honor, is the jury not going to deliberate on Friday?
The jury has indicated to us that they don't want to work on Friday.
And what will
they have the matter of the one juror who has these doctor appointments. And
will it be 10 to 4:30 on the other days?
My instructions to the jury is that we expect them to hear from 10 to 4:30, but that we are available for longer hours if they wish to at any time to do that. If they want to come early, stay late, we'll be here.
And what is Your Honor?
My guess is they'll go from 10 to 4:30, but I don't know.
What is Your Honor's preference about our where we are?
My preference is that you be within, you know, what questions are going to come up, I'm sure. Although I thought my charge was so clear, I can't imagine that. Didn't you, Mr. Kogan?
I had no objection to the last phase. The last phase of the charge, the second set is fine. The first
okay.
One, you know my
okay. Opinion. But there will be, the questions will come up. I want to be in phone contact with you initially, and we can all go over the phone. But then you know you have to be here when I submit
well,
the
as
answer.
Long as okay. We'd like to be a block away at our office.
You can be a block away. Yeah, where the fence going to be?
I'll be bringing people in for proffers, I guess, we'll meet with them.
you'll be nearby so you can get here,
I'll be here.
Fairly quickly.
I mean, we're at 20th Market. We can get here in 10 minutes.
But we'll do a phone conference on the questions and then, okay?
Your Honor, can Matt contact someone from the Marshal Service so we can get into the courtroom tomorrow morning, like around 8 o'clock or 8:15?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be here.
Yeah, okay.
I'll be here.
Okay. Very well. See you.
Thank you very much,
Henry. The jury has decided to leave and start tomorrow. So
yeah, that's what I thought they'd be the best thing to do. Okay, good. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow morning then.